This is the Chasing Tomorrow podcast with Joe Gagnon. We bring you captivating conversations that will inspire all of us to go after our own version of a high-performance life.
Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. I'm on with my best buddy, longtime co-host again. One episode was not enough. We have so much more to talk about. The fun about this, Dave Proctor, of course, with me, is that because of what we've learned over the past few years, there's a great foundation. And since you and I spoke, I could not stop thinking about what else did I want to ask Dave? What deeper insights can we pull from the experience that you have had, have gone through, are intending to go forward with, trying to sort of pull out of this sort of human story, your Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, more insight, deeper insights. We love that the psychologists and the therapists can do their thing, but we're going to do our own thing here. So, Dave, how are you feeling? How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Joe. I'm doing good. Yeah, ever since our last conversation, I've just been curious about a lot of the things we were talking about, and I wanted to dive even a bit further. So thanks for having me back on again. This is going to be fun.
So we're going to sort of talk in three themes for our audience here today. The first theme, we're going to talk about sort of the thing that Dave and I are not experts in, but we use every day, this neurobiology that keeps us going. We've talked about all of us in endurance athletics, a dopamine system, which is a motivation system. It's not really a reward system. It's a motivation system of cortisol, which is a stress response system. When we are loved, there's oxytocin that flows through us, serotonin's the drug of love. There's other things. GABA is the modulator that helps us fall asleep. There are all these neurochemicals that we, most humans, don't know anything about. And I don't know them at a very, very surface level. They're also called passive systems, meaning you can't access them. You can only disrupt them or use them. And they're mostly there because evolution figured out these things matter. Motivation matters to go find the food. Love matters to feel connected. All these things, we have to sleep. And so as I thought about a little bit what kept you going, but then what happened afterwards, I have this sort of idea I want to run by you. And so we've heard of the Michael Phelps story. He's had 17 gold medals or something, and very proactively went out to the market and said, hey, I need a therapist. I'm really struggling. We know other gold medal winners who have states of depression. We have high performers, so on, career people of imposter syndrome. And so I was thinking about, though, sometimes that doesn't create such damage that you had afterwards. And I know you've been open about it, so we're good to talk about that. But you went through a very difficult time. So here's my theory, Dave, that the dopamine system was what kept you going every day. The motivation, through the pain, through anything. Didn't matter what the world threw at you, you went through it. You got to the end, and then actually you didn't deplete it, you broke it. Gas tank, you literally broke the engine in half. And then you had to spend a year and a half rebuilding the engine. And I wonder if when we go to such a degree, which is not a judgment in any way, if indeed that's actually what's happening. And so our biological systems are, oops, now what? This is not working. I don't know if that's even possible, but there's something else exogenous that happened here. What do you think? Because you're the guy who felt it. Yeah. You feel sort of just so different that the normal feelings weren't working.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't just necessarily that my feelings weren't, that I wasn't feeling my normal feelings. It was that I was feeling somebody else's feelings. And it didn't make sense of making that other person's feelings understood. So yeah, one step further, Joe, I would say you're completely right. It felt after the run across Canada, I was utterly broken. I feel like it wasn't necessarily that my car needed an oil change and a tune-up. It was that the engine chassis snapped in half. It was that it was no longer a car. And I think that, Joe, I think that some people would listen to the podcast and shake their head and think, why would you ever do that?
Right.
I've been getting some reviews on my book saying, why? Like, why on earth? Why would you ever do that? Whereas a different subset of people are going, oh my goodness, this is the coolest story ever. Because I would like to do this. I would like to push everything so hard that my engine cracked. And so I think you have a couple different sets of people out there. But to your point, I think I couldn't agree more. I think that there has to be, when it comes to the razor's edge of what humans are capable of, there has to be a breaking point and a thin, thin red line that you take yourself out onto and then mentally push yourself to a way that you can end up tightroping that longer than the last guy until you can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And ultimately too, Joe, the next day, the day 68, when I didn't need to run anymore, you had an out. You don't need to run, so you don't run. So now you deal with the consequences of breaking your engine.
Yeah. It's so interesting you use that analogy, because I was talking to one of my buddies about this and I said, you can redline a car once and you're probably okay. When you redline the car 10 times, that redline, for anyone who in modern day cars, we don't have tachometers. So with this language we're using, there is a gauge that was in cars years ago that would show how many revolutions per minute the engine was going. And would give you a red line, so don't go above this, 5,000 RPMs, whatever it was. And if you went over it, you might have some problems. But if you keep going over it, it says it's basically going to break. So I think, I'm not saying 67 times, but because maybe a few days in there was, but it just kept happening and you kept breaking it. And you were pushing the car, really, you know, broken foot and all of the issues you had. The thing though that, so let's go a little bit deeper into this. Like, when we don't really know what happened, then it's a hard process to then work through. So whether this thesis is right about that dopamine system breaking, something actually broke and it was going to take some kind of healing process. Our normal healing is through sleep.
Yes.
So you've gone so deep that a night of sleep was not going to repair. So what do you think during the process was part of the repair for you? What was repairing your system? What was giving you, even if it wasn't active hope, some kind of hope that if I kept moving forward, I'm fixing this? Was there any of that?
Yeah, and I think in the past, when I've had hardships or struggles in my life, yes, talking to a psychologist is great. Taking supplements and support is great. Getting an extra hour a night of sleep works. And that works great for 99% of the times in my life where I feel like I've crossed that line. They've definitely been enough to support the system. But you don't take your car to a mechanic when the block is fractured in half and saying, hey, it just won't shift from the fourth gear to the fifth gear.
Right.
You what are they going to do? That you would not repair that car. You have to kind of start from the ground up. And so that's been my approach with the recovery ever since that I started really recognizing that this is as bad as it was. Mm-hmm. I need to rebuild the system from the ground up. Because I feel like I did something hard enough and long enough that the former me, the former Dave, is no longer. And so I feel that the very best thing that I did to recover during this whole process was, and I think it's a thing that men don't do often, is journal. And my extension of the journal was writing a book, kind of stringing together all of my thoughts, making sense of my feelings, and being quiet with a cup of peppermint tea and classical music playing in the background and writing. It's something that I've never experienced before. I've never been like an artistic person, but kind of swimming in the arts, I feel for me was, and it still has been, in fact, I'm still writing day to day here, because even though I have nothing to write about, I feel like it's very, very healing to make sense of your thoughts and feelings, kind of working within your system to build up your own system from within.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, because you were probably leveraging another part of your brain, maybe the hippocampus and the amygdala more than anything else. So the interesting part about it is what you used to do to heal yourself was to go for a run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that wasn't available to you.
Not even close. Yeah. Well, number one, my body was so broken, right?
Yeah.
I fractured bones and even the MRI came back and all my bones were bruised in my southern hemisphere. So what do you have to let that rest. If you wanted to recover, you got to let it rest. And so, yeah, I couldn't go back to my usual standard of just going out for a hard run or an easy run or a bike ride or lifting weights or whatever it is. Yeah, it was that you're now reliant upon something that's very foreign to you that you've never had to use before.
Right.
And I think most of our listeners could agree that that would be tough. Like we have our three or four things that we typically circle back to. What if all of those things were taken or not taken, but not available or even made matters worse? Where do you lean? What do you do? How do you support yourself? And how do you not become a destructive a-hole being jerks to everybody?
Yeah, well, that's the biggest risk, right? That you're broken, and that broken system person starts to actually be even more destructive, not just to themselves, but to others.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we see it all the time. We see it all the time. I mean, like, you look at alcoholics, you look at people coming off of drug abuse. Yeah, it almost seems in part that they want the world to hate them. They want to they want people to see them in the way that they see themselves. And that's what I wrote in my book as well, too, is I was almost wanting people to hate me as much as I hated myself in that moment. And you are nothing more than the 20 people around you in your life. And you can ruin those relationships pretty quick.
Sadly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So broken system can heal though, right? And which is what you figured out. As you've gone through it, talk a little bit about though how you have to meter that, because you can sort of both be like up and down. And so do you like try and be sort of calm and sort of understated as you're getting better so that you don't get too excited and then pull back from that? Any feelings of that too?
Yeah, I think the main thing that I've noticed is for myself is don't feel too cocky and too comfortable that you're good now.
Yeah.
Because every time you feel like you're out of the woods, no, you're not feeling great again, or you're feeling something that you don't want to feel. I think the biggest thing for me personally was noticing how I was feeling and sitting and falling into meditation 2, 3, 4 times a day. And especially during those times when you're feeling something that you kind of want to sit with, you want to be present with. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those feelings don't need to be fixed. Sometimes you don't need to work away from those thoughts and ideas, but you do need to notice them and you do need to give reverence to them. So that's what I would do in my meditations is just notice that I'm irritated or agitated, frustrated, angry. And it's funny when you start to push on the side of that anger, when you start to notice your anger and you give it a name, it tends to kind of vanish like a cloud in the sky. I don't know, Joe, is that your experience as well?
Yeah, in a slightly, yes, in this way. I think if you can have this self-awareness about how you feel and you announce that to the world, it creates less strain for you and for the rest of the world. So Dave says to his family, hey, I'm in really bad mood today. So I might say something stupid that he'll take the wrong way, but I can't get out of this bad mood. And okay, no problem, Dad. That's okay. We understand. And so you say something dopey and they just laugh because you set a good context. No one's taking it personally. And so now you've disarmed both parties. Someone listening might come home from a bad day at work and they don't tell anyone and they're with their partner and all of a sudden they're blowing up. But it has nothing to do with that person. They take it personally. Instead of saying, hey, it's a tough day at work, could be a bit of a jerk here, so sorry for that. It's probably just me processing this out. And then that acknowledgement that you just talked about, I think, is a very important skill in relationships. And then it helps us too, because we've then said it and we've sort of almost burst it by doing that. Then we don't create any issues. So yeah, I think that's a really important skill to continue to work on throughout.
Well, yeah. And even one step further. Yeah. I remember listening to, I think it was Brene Brown a couple of years ago. And you know, she was making mention of coming home and telling her husband, hey, I've had a terrible day. I've got these deadlines that I haven't met up with. I'm stressed about this with the kids, with school and on and so forth. I've got 20%. That's all I got. I got 20%.
Yeah.
And he circled back and said, you know what? I got your 80. Right. You go sit down. I'll get a cup of tea going.
Yeah.
I got your 80. And but sometimes she comes home and says, honey, I got 20. And he says, you know what? I've got 20 as well, too. Let's order in dinner. And so sometimes it's such a great intimate moment that you have with your loved ones when you can end up saying, hey, I need some help here. Do you got me? And you didn't have an opportunity.
Coming off of this, Dave's a Superman because he did something. You are in a very unique category. This isn't just, I don't know, that you ran a good marathon. I mean, you literally set a world record that had established forever. And you did it even in a more substantive way. And it also was the drama of having tried it. And so this success could be so intimidating to everyone else in addition. So Dave's intimidating because of his success. And now he's sort of not himself. That's a pretty complicated situation.
Well, it sure is. Absolutely. And I think that most people wouldn't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
If you kept it to yourself, if you didn't announce that there was a tiger in the room, then, well, geez, I'm not going to bring it up because Dave's not bringing it up. And so it comes down to leadership and it comes down to trusting the people that you have around you, I think, because they're there for a reason. You've put them there.
Yeah, the storytelling about this kind of topic is becoming more well-known. Like actually on Netflix, there's a Mark Cavendish story, you know, this great Tour de France cyclist, and they interview his wife a bunch. And, you know, she's on the edge all the time of, this guy is literally a jerk. He might be one of the best cyclists of all time, but... And he was always a bit of a jerk, but sometimes I think high performers are. I would say, just personally, not to stroke you, you were never that kind of guy. You were always really very down the middle, straight and humble. But anyway, later on, he gets this coach who says to him, Mark, you're just a jerk. Let's just put it on the table here.
Absolutely. Let's call it what it is. Yeah.
Oh. And I think it was, but had that someone said that to him like 10 years before, it wouldn't have landed. He would have just yelled back at them. So there's sometimes where the messages are only relevant at the right time.
Yeah.
And so have you found sort of that also as you've gone through this, we'll call it recovery, that it's some days easier to hear things and you say, oh, wow, thanks, versus defensiveness?
Yeah, yes. I feel that throughout this process, 95% of the time, it's me that's leading the conversations. You know, nobody wants to mess up. Nobody wants to ruin a relationship. How many times would you love your partner or your kids or your best friend to come to you and say, listen, Joe, I'm really struggling here and I could really stand to talk about this. It gives you an opportunity as a best friend or as a husband to be there for your partner. And so how often do we come out, but just simply because of fear, like we don't want to lose that person, we don't want to harm that relationship. And how many times do we have to initiate that ourselves and have the bravery to go to your partner and say, listen, I am having a really hard time here. And this is precisely what I feel like I need from you. Tell me if I'm wrong. And I feel like when I go there 95% of the time, 94% of the time, it lands where it needs to land. And I think that having the bravery and having the bravery, I guess, to run across the country and to stand on one side of the second biggest country in the world and to look across and say, yeah, I've got that. It also unlocks an opportunity in your personal life where you didn't feel strong enough or brave enough or confident enough to be able to approach a conversation, a difficult conversation that you know would end well, but just in case you don't go there.
Yeah.
I think that bravery comes in. It's like a virus. It comes in and it takes over. And I feel like now in the last year plus since the run, I feel like I'm a lot braver of a person. I'm a lot more available than I was before.
Wow. Yeah, that's a cool point because they're the same word applied differently, give a very different feeling. The brave guy willing to run through wind, rain, snow, every condition versus the brave guy willing to talk about himself as a human and fallible and insecure.
Hey guys, Joe Gagnon, host of the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. And this episode is brought to you by 1UP Health. 1UP Health is a modern cloud data and interoperability platform that makes it easy to acquire, store, and share data between payers, providers, and patients. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Right.
Well, I think that when we see a lot of characters out there, we see a lot of our idols. You look at the Olympics, you look at business leaders, and you don't see that often. But yet, they have to have their people. I was watching the Super Bowl on the weekend, and there's Taylor Swift up in and she was the biggest star in the stadium, of course.
Yep.
And she's got to have her people. She's got to be real and vulnerable to her people. And that gives her strength to come out into the world, right? We all have to have our 10 or 20 people around us.
Yeah. Yeah, because we're all the same at the end of the day. There might be talent, but there's nothing different in that human system. So I've also been thinking about, okay, so for those of you who don't know this, Dave not only had lots of world records, whether it's treadmills or other kinds of running records, that he knew that he could run across Canada faster than anyone else. And so he actually made an attempt and it didn't go well. Then you made the second and you made it and finished it. I sort of always wonder, like, had you not finished the second one, would you have gone out to do a third one? Was this something that there's no way Dave would have left the planet if he didn't get across Canada in record time, or at least get across Canada completely?
Yeah, Joe, I've wondered about that myself too. I've thought many times that I convinced myself before the second attempt in 2022 that this was my last attempt.
Yeah.
And I think that you kind of have to do that, because I think if you have a backup plan that, oh, no, if it doesn't work out this go around, I'll hit it up again in two more years and I will be successful. Then you're going to quit and start doing it again in 2 years. I believe that. So I did convince myself, and I feel like I felt completely honorable that that was the truth that I knew. But Joe, you know me. If I didn't complete it and I was capable of completing it, I would be back out there again. I think we all have our Canada. I think we all have our Everest. And there's a race. I was talking with a friend the other day. It's a race up here in Canada. It's called Sinister Seven. And it's got a pretty tough cutoff of 30 hours. And 30 hours for a 100-mile race with, I think it's 18,000 feet of elevation. It's a good race. There's a lot of people who have completed or have attempted it 5-6 times, but they get to the final aid station. They time out. They can't. Yeah, right. And guess where they're coming back to again next year? That same race. That's their Canada. That's their Everest. And I think it's one of those things that people like you and I and a lot of our listeners have in our blood. It's in your DNA. I don't know what kind of marker there is for that. But I think it's the unfinished business gene. It's knowing that you've got something, that you left something on the table that you could better yourself next time to complete. And I think that we have that, you and I, Joe, and a lot of our listeners. Maybe that's why the listeners are listening right now.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I think you would have gone out and done it again. We've seen, like, the Olympics are every 4 years, and some people have gone back 4 or 5 times. It takes 20 years to win the gold medal, and pressure gets higher, and they fail in between. It's a bit of this hero's journey, the transcendence piece at the end. Actually, what I think is, it's in business, we call it the next S curve. There is another growth curve. And so I don't think that if you have figured that system out, that you'd ever stop. Like I think that there's the, when I started doing the Ironman racing, I always thought it's amazing if you do one, but you really need to do 3 to actually sort of prove that you were an Ironman. And that's not being self. It just was a bit of this, okay, get beyond the excitement and get into that's what you become. Mm-hmm. Once you become that, then that's what you live. And it's not that, so relative to someone else who's made other choices, if you become a concert violinist, that's, you are that. And you're always going to keep the envelope and take on some new scales or whatever it might be. So I think that we won't really be able to, in this episode, we could try another 5, figure out like what happened when we were kids that made this true. There's something that we're still trying to solve for. But as long as we make it constructive and productive, I think that it's okay to have these, your Canada, that could be a good line. What's your Canada? And figure it out with a bunch of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everybody would have a different answer. And some people who aren't athletic, they would say it's retiring at the age of 55. Somebody, it's everybody's got their Canada. Everybody's got their, what their life goal would be, human achievement, the top of what they're capable of doing. At least that's what they set their bar at. And I agree. But there's got to be something that happened when we were younger that kind of ignited it. I think that we all have that gene. I think we do. But I think it's expressed early in life by something that happened, a message that was given to you by your father, noticing something, going, I can improve in this way. And then seeing those benefits from that improvement. I think that's another hour long conversation altogether.
Yeah, I think we'll stay away from my mother used to tell me every day, you can do better. You can do better.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
You have that in there. The idea of the peak performance is becoming, I think, more a bit of lingua franca, and that people are talking about what peak performance. So if we were to index all of us at 100, meaning that's the maximum, doesn't matter if 100 is whatever it means. The question in life is how close do you get to 100? And I think the thesis goes that it's actually, you can't get to 100 because we actually don't know what human performance is possible. We keep on moving it. I mean, if we took out measurement, maybe we would max out. Like if we didn't have a watch, would we ever run a 4-minute mile? If we didn't have a grade, would we have ever gotten a 4.0? Like I think the measurement system works well for humans. The way we can tick things off, 67 days, 67 miles a day. Like there's all this, it works well for references in our heads. And I think the more we do that, the easier it is. They use it or lose it. Also, Dave, as we get older, I've found, it was this silly thing last year. I was, I should try and do 100,000 push-ups, which is this 3-day And I got to 110,000 because I had built a little cushion this year. I said, I wonder if I could do 150,000. In the first 5 days of the year, the increase from 300 to 410 a day. Oh, wow. That was a bit shocking.
Oh, yeah.
But now on February 12th, 13th, okay, I got it now. Now it's just keeping it going. So can I go to 200,000 next year? It just seems that as long as you're willing to do that sort of that moment of breakthrough, whatever. These are just easy. Talk about sporting activities. It's easy because they're easy to measure. But the rest of life's the same way. As you think about like this, what are your daily activities now? What are you doing? Are you running now? How are you feeling? You're doing other activities?
Yeah. So unfortunately, and I even wrote about it in my book about my injury back in 2018, I herniated a disc in my lower back. And something I haven't been very public about is that every year it comes back and it slips out and it's worse. And it slipped out again before Christmas and it's now way worse. And Ooh. So my surgeon has been wanting to do this for a while. And so, yeah, going in for back surgery this week. So I'm going to get a microdiscectomy on L5S1. And so unfortunately, walking around the kitchen hurts. So unfortunately, I have to go and resolve that. And so when it comes to activity right now, it's very, very little. But I'm also really eager to get back at things. I'm so excited about getting back out and running. I'm not going to run across Canada again. I'm not going to go and do a big thing like that. But yeah. I'm going to circle back to the things that were kind of floating my boat in years before with backyard racing and 24-hour racing and mountain 100-mile racing and just fun things. Go and empty your tank on a course and then be okay 2 weeks later. I love that. But I think what I'm doing right now, what I've kind of committed to myself right now, what I've noticed is bending the needle the most for me is motivating others. Oh, I've done a thing. I've written a book about it. The neatest thing is it's a good book. I didn't know that I could write. And then you write and you read it and you think, hey, this is legible. Like this people are enjoying this book. But Joe, one of the coolest things happened yesterday. I was asked to come back to the elementary school that I went to elementary school in when I was in grades 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in High River, where I grew up. My parents still live there. And I was able to speak in front of the entire school and tell them my story. And the conversation was circling around the run, but it was mostly circling around believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really key message that a lot of kids need to hear is the things that you think that you're not good at, they might just need a little bit of work, you know? Yeah. And so I told them my story about how if you ended up back in the 1980s when I was going to school there, if you end up failing, they don't fail kids anymore or hold them back. But if you end up failing a class, you were not smart. You needed to be held back. And so failed not one grade, but 3 grades. I was not a good reader and I was not a good writer. And so I stood firm that I was not a smart kid. But yep. I loved running. And so I started talking about the Terry Fox run. And they still run around the same lake that I ran back 35, 37 years ago. And I told them, I said, I've struggled to get around that lake once back then. But fast forward 35 years, I ran 140 of those lakes every day for 67 days in a row. And you should have seen the kids, their eyes widen when they, because in Canada, all kids know Terry Fox. All the kids learn about his lessons that he taught me and now them 35 years later. And I circled back at the end of the conversation. I said, I convinced myself when I was your age that I was dumb and I was not a smart kid and that I couldn't write. In fact, I was the one kid in my class who failed 3 times. Then now I'm in my mid 40s and I get done a run and I feel it's kind of right to write a book. And I wrote a book and it's good. So I was wrong all along.
Yeah.
I'm not dumb. I convinced myself when I was 7 and 8 years old that I couldn't do something. And you would be the biggest travesty, Joe, would be that I would die in my 80s still convinced that I was dumb.
Yeah.
When I think that a lot of us convince ourselves, oh, no, I'm not a runner. I can't cycle. I can't do those hard things. Yeah. Whoever told you that, and why did you start believing them? And that was my message to the kids and seeing their faces at the end. And then I got to apologize to all the parents because the kids came up to me and, hey, could you sign my shoes? And so I signed like half the kids' shoes, and these are probably nice white sneakers. And I hope I don't get any terrible letters home from the parents saying, hey, you ruined my kids' new sneakers. But yeah, it was pretty neat. You don't know the impact that you have when you can go and relate a good message to kids at a young, impressionable age.
First, thanks for doing that. We need more of that. Second, I think a lot of us feel the same way. The third is it is said that someone tells us something and we believe them more than we believe ourselves.
Yes.
And we just cannot fall into that trap. Oh, in fourth grade, someone says, you're not good at math, and the rest of your life, you don't think you're not good at math. Like, what in heaven's name did that person even know in that moment? Like, seriously? So
yeah.
I think we need to always listen and also understand, but not form judgment from that. That's hard, but we have to really bring our own sensibility to that. And I think that took you a while to get there. I think it takes us all a while to get there. Part of what we're fighting against, because that's actually not true at all for any of us.
No, none. Why did we start believing all of these things? Joe, you might say, you know what? I'm not a musical guy. I don't know how to play the piano. Yeah, when did you start believing that? Who told you that? You might like music, so you might have an ear for it. Who knows? You might come through your fingertips. And that's the same thing goes, and that's what I love about endurance sport, is it is damn hard. Running 100 miles is hard.
Yeah. Right?
And it's easy to convince yourself that you can't, or that it's too far, or that's meant for other people, like real athletes, right? But there's nothing more empowering. There's nothing more empowering than doing something that you've convinced yourself all your life that you can't do, and then you do.
Yeah.
So cool.
The first time someone said run 100 miles, I was, I don't even know what you're talking about. So I...
How? Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. The other connection to me is sort of, we hold so hard and fast on something we believe to be true or the way we are, and we'll never change that. So, of course, most people really do like eating meat. I became a vegetarian. I was the biggest meat eater in the world. And I'm not saying anyone needs to do what I did. I just am suggesting that I was the equal no of everyone else. Never, ever. No. Why would you do that? That's stupid kind of thing. I just have sort of learned a little bit. Like, don't close the window at any point in time. You can stay where you are, but just keep it open to possibilities, to thinking, to the spirit of it. And the best part of what you did with the kids, boy, we could have some fun together, because I had so many people tell me, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do this, all throughout, you know. And when I did that 6-marathon, 6-continent challenge in 6 days, they went, well, planes won't take off. You'll turn your ankle. What happens if you get sick? What all the unrest? And like, oh my God, let me just go find out. Okay. I just want to experience it. A judgment beforehand. Sometimes it may work out. Sometimes it may not work out. But that isn't the reason not to do something in life. You know,
right.
It's the experience. For as hard as what you did was, and how much it broke you, that experience still is nothing short of remarkable. What you saw, who you met, how you felt. You and I talked while you were running, and you were transcendent in those moments, Dave. You were saying things that, like, you couldn't sit in a couch and say, because you'd never feel it. So
yeah. And all the listeners out there, circle back to those conversations that Joe and I were having that we were talking about. Every week we were out, sometimes in the hotel room, but most of the time out on the highway. And just look past all the vehicles driving by, especially the transport trucks. It got a bit loud, but you're skipping, you're laughing, you're dancing out there. It's a beautiful thing to kind of live that at least once in your life, to kind of be that dragon. But to circle back a little bit, Joe, about what you were saying a second ago about belief and how belief can also be that thing that kind of strangles you, that kind of tethers you and holds you down. But belief can also be that thing that releases you, that creates an opportunity that makes you relatively boundless. And so, if you believe that you can't do something, you can't do it, you won't do
it.
It's impossible. But if you believe that you will be okay, if you believe that I can get through this process now, I'll have the patience to go through this training block and get this done or learn that new skill set or whatever that is, that I think is the most freeing feeling in the world of unleashing belief and going, okay, you know what? I thought that I was going to be limited by this, but in fact, it did triple that. If that's the case, then what other self-limiting beliefs do I have? And at what point am I untethered?
Yeah, I know. I'm chuckling because I've spent so much time in my life doing what everyone else finds either boring and I make it exciting. So for five straight years, I ate peanut butter and jelly for lunch every day. Dave, every morning.
You never grew up, do you?
No, I was so excited.
I love it.
Oh my God, I can have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch.
Why not?
And everyone listening to this would be like, I wouldn't do that every day. It was, I just convinced myself it was exciting every day. Like mm-hmm. It literally was. And I still love having peanut butter and jelly. And so these limits that we put on ourselves for how we feel and how we look at it are just up to us. Yeah.
They are. Yeah.
Why? And it's not about the success of breaking a record. It's actually just about the success of falling in love with life and the journey and sort of the experience and the difficulties and sort of just keep on reframing around, this is it, baby. Let's enjoy this thing.
Yeah. And sometimes I think that when it comes to those limits that we put around ourselves, sometimes there's a good reason for it, but most of the time there's not. Right? Like if you really, really kind of parsed back, let's say your fear of public speaking, and if you kind of pulled it back and further back and further back, and you realize, wow, okay, I'm afraid of being ridiculed and being judged by, well, they're all showing up to see you. They're all showing up to listen to you. So really, ultimately, do you really have a fear? I mean, when you go swimming in the ocean with sharks, but you're afraid of public speaking, is that really something that you really should be afraid of? And the honest answer, the more you kind of dive into it and open that conversation up for yourself, you're like, no, I shouldn't be limiting myself when it comes to that. And so I feel that kind of the self-limiting beliefs are one of those envelopes that once you open up one, you open up 10. Mm. And it's a mindset where a lot of our listeners are going right now with, oh, okay, what am I limiting? What am I kind of, what are some of my beliefs that I hate taxes? Well, why do you hate taxes? I think that's a pretty common hate, but for many reasons. But I think that ultimately it's not really all that scary. It's just a thing you got to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You know, all you have to do is just give yourself the sort of, today it was raining, snowing, windy, cold in the Boston area, which is where I am. And everyone's, oh, you're going to run on the treadmill. These are the days that I actually want to go outside. Hmm. The crazier the weather, the more the exhilaration, the sort of power that I have. Look, I'm just jogging. I'm not like going hard. But to go experience that and deal with a little bit of the discomfort, just like feel like, oh my God, this is like a wildly amazing opportunity. What if I sat in my hotel room, like, or went on the treadmill? Like what? Nothing, not much happening. So yeah, I think that every one of these little bits, and there were more people out there than I thought. Some people walking with their cup of coffee. I was so impressed. I'm like, hey, look at that. Hmm. Get out of the house and we should just do this, whatever it is that we sort of think is uncomfortable, and do it some more.
Yeah. And very further to that point, I remember there was a great book that I read from Jon Kabat-Zinn, and it's called Falling Awake. And I think the title pretty much explains the entire book. And those days where it's windy and cold and rainy and blustery or stupidly hot. It's impossible to not notice. It's impossible to not be aware and awake to your surroundings instead of locking into your phone and your music and you end up arriving at your destination. You don't even know how you got here.
I know.
That wind makes you aware that the wind is there. And so it's a great excuse to feel. It really is.
I saw something, Dave, that I've never seen. So I'm running along the water here in the Boston area, and the foam from the ocean was forming the shore. And it was so windy that the foam was being blown over the fence onto the walkway. It looked like 5-6 inches of snow, but it was just sea foam that was in big chunks being blown. I'm like, I don't know when I'd ever see it again. It was just, if I wasn't out there, I would never have experienced it. This is why I'm happy that you sort of have gotten through all the challenge, still knowing there's risk. So this sort of, one of the things I was thinking is, we've done episodes with Pete Kostelnik, you and me. Pete, as we know, has got the US record running across, and he had an accident last summer. He's been recovering. He's back jogging and running. And I saw him post on Instagram this week that he has this like big set of races coming up. And so I was thinking what we should do is get the three of us on and talk about, how does one set up the next stage of this? You go through a big, hard challenge and you can either get stuck, or you can not just be untethered, you can be unleashed.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is the other side of untethered.
Well, yeah.
So this unleashing idea, what do you think about it? Unleash that wild tiger inside Dave next.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, everybody's got a different story. And I like story. Pete's story is certainly not done. No. Pete, even if he were to stop, he is a living ultra legend who's done incredible things, who's left his mark. I still think that the Trans-American speed record is going to stand for many, many more years. I don't think that people quite understand how hard of a record that is to break. But he's done other things as well, too, the key-to-key run and on and so forth. Oh, yeah. The guy is a complete legend. But it's his path. And yeah. I feel, and he's also my junior in age. So he's still, even though if he keeps getting into car accidents, he's going to start walking around like he's 70 years old pretty quick. He's got his journey. And you see this kind of fire and burn within him that you want to see in amongst all your friends, right? Mm. So you can't say, hey, simmer down, relax. Or, hey, that should be enough. Because if it was me, that would be enough. Because he's not me. He's still got a story to tell. He's still got a life to live when it comes to his running abilities and going and doing hard things. And you look at his calendar coming up. These are hard things. Like, oof. The guy is leaning right into the hardest of things, coming off of a major hip surgery or pelvic surgery. So, you know, for me personally, I am returning back to running. I would love to return to endurance cycling. But I think in the meantime, I'm kind of putting aside the big numbered goals of going. And I certainly want to go back and win Big's Backyard again. Not again. I haven't won it. I got third that one year. But that's certainly something that after seeing Harvey's 108 hours, I want to run 109. And I think it's very doable. I think as long as you stay within a certain mindset and a certain state. But I will end up going back there, and I'm going to start the approach this next year. But Joe, there's something really quite beautiful and interesting about storytelling, and that this is such a growing sport, the sport of ultramarathoning. We're only seeing the very beginnings of something that human potential is being redefined in front of us. And it's not just the elites that are going out and doing big things, but it's people that have never run a step in their life and they're signing up for a 100-kilometer race. Yeah, like, that is so cool. Amazing, but all of these people are new to the ultra running world, and they need, I really wish that there were really great resources when I was younger getting started in the sport, because I would have done things very differently instead of just figuring it out on my own, which that Joe, you and I needed to do.
Right.
But I think that there is a means of storytelling that what's better, going out and running and winning a 100-mile race, or going and helping 100 people in achieving something that they never thought that they would ever be able to do. I would think 3 years ago that I would say the first, but now I'm saying the latter.
Well, I'm with you on that journey. And I think we'll close it there, because I think we should all think about how we support each other, how you're doing mm-hmm. that, Dave, how I endeavor to do that every day, how we could do it as a collective and make a bigger impact than just the individual performance, which is still great, but we all have a deeper purpose. And I think you're finding it. We're going to check back in with you after the surgery, see how you're doing. It may be the one time I should go run a 10K with you and see if I can keep up. Thanks, Dave, for being so open and honest and continuing to share your story. It really matters to me and to all the listeners and everyone else. Thanks for that.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe. Let's do it again soon.